I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. First, happy holiday to everybody out there who's celebrating 4th of July, day off from work, long weekend, whatever you're doing, be safe, enjoy. There's so much wild stuff happening in the world that we don't always find time for joy, so I hope today and this long weekend has been a time for joy for you. Second is I have Andy Slavitt on the pod today, giving us another update on healthcare. I personally learned so much from him, and so much as we talked about healthcare, I hope you're learning too. Then we have Senator Schatz from Hawaii also on the pod today. And the last thing I'll say is about fear. So there are a lot of people who have said that they are afraid in this moment. And we talk about fear because of the current political context, because all of the things happening across a host of sectors. And I've heard some people say that they are fearless, right? That the fear is completely gone. And I don't know if that is necessarily either healthy or the best approach. I think that it makes sense to be fearful of some things. I think I get how the fear manifests. What I'd say is that I believe that the goal is to make sure the fear doesn't overpower the other emotions. That we know fear is often parasitic, that it eats at our courage and our joy. And that when we are at our best, I think that our fear works in concert with our other emotions, but it doesn't overpower them. That part of our work as organizers, as activists, as citizens, is to acknowledge the fear and do the work anyway. It's to see the fear and not let it take over. And it's to manage the fear so that it doesn't become something that drives or motivates the way that you act in the world. That doesn't mean that the fear completely goes away. We are human. We are people who live full lives, and all of our emotions can be present at the same time. And I think that with fear, it's about making sure that it doesn't overpower or eat at the other emotions. With that said, let's get into the pod. Andy, it's great to have you back. You are like the one of the most consistent parts of Pod Save the People because you are so informative, and I appreciate you helping us wade through the healthcare issue. Can you tell us what's up?
Well, since we talked last week, DeRay, we've had a couple of developments. First of all, the Republicans in the Senate who are trying to get this this bill passed, this bill to repeal and replace the ACA, have figured out that they don't have the votes. And so they originally wanted to get this done by the 4th of July, and they realized they're not able to do it. So that's the first thing that happened, and I think the reason that that's happened is because there's been a lot of visibility over the fact that a lot of people are going to lose coverage, that people on Medicaid are going to have a lot of that money taken away. And there's been some pretty public analysis, which has showed that people are going to pay more money to get their health insurance. So they're busy working, trying to make a deal. And I think everybody should know that when you don't hear something out of Washington for a couple of days, it doesn't mean nothing's happening. It generally means the doors are closed and people are trading deals. And the McConnell, who is the leader in the Senate, is spending money from the bill. He's got a couple of $100 billion that he can spend in the bill and still make this bill budget neutral. And he's working with different senators right now to meet those needs. Some of them are very conservative people like Ted Cruz, and he's working on giving them things which would remove patient protections. And some of them are people from states that don't want to lose coverage. So that's the job that's going on right now.
Now, when we last spoke, you seemed to suggest that we shouldn't count McConnell out, right? That like he is a long game sort of guy. Do you still believe that?
I do. I think his job has gotten harder because the more publicity there is over this bill and the more people over the 4th of July holiday are getting in the face of their senators, the more difficult it gets. Conventional wisdom. Now, remember, there's 52 Republicans right now in the Senate, and he needs 50 votes plus Mike Pence, the vice president, to break the tie. So he can afford to lose two votes, but not three. The conventional wisdom is that there are two votes that may be out of reach, Susan Collins of Maine and Rand Paul in Kentucky. And they're both out of reach for two different reasons. But if that's true, then that means he can only afford to lose one more vote or this thing fails. And so there's a lot of focus on a couple senators right now. Dean Heller is the senator in Nevada who is up again for reelection. There's a lot of pressure on him from both the Republican fundraisers and from Democrats and from the governor, pushing both directions. Lisa Murkowski from Alaska is also a lot of pressure on her. And there's a few others. But suffice it to say, if one more person decides to vote no and the other two stick, then McConnell's not going to be able to get this passed.
Now, why Rand Paul and why Susan Collins? Like, why are they backing out?
So it's for complete opposite reasons. Rand Paul believes that not enough of the ACA is being torn down. He wants to see it all go. He wants to see it completely repealed.
Really?
And he believes, yep. And he believes that there's just too much in its place. So he might be willing to compromise a little bit. But from his take, things like pre-existing conditions, we need to be more explicitly removed, things of that nature. And the things that he wants would be things that a lot of other senators would have problems with. So that's why people think he's a no. Susan Collins, she's considered the most moderate senator in the Republican caucus. And she doesn't like the fact that a lot of people are losing Medicaid coverage. And she doesn't like the fact that a lot of people are going to have problems with pre-existing conditions. And she's generally been willing to buck the party more than any other senator. And so she's been fairly firm, but for the complete opposite reason of Rand Paul.
Now, can you help us understand all the hoopla and fuss around pre-existing conditions? I've heard a lot of people talk about that, you know, this and this is a pre-existing condition and pre-existing conditions are either under attack or they're a big issue. What is the issue?
So the issue is this. If you were designing an insurance system for people, you'd say, well, we have to insure them for things that are going to make them sick. But if you were designing a system for insurance companies, you would say, well, let's not make the insurance company have to give insurance to somebody who's likely to get sick. Or if we do, let's let them charge them more money. And before the ACA, that's exactly how it used to work. Now, what the ACA did was it made it illegal to even ask someone about what conditions they had. And I can tell you that in 2008, 2009, before the ACA, you'd have to fill out oftentimes a 40 or 50 page questionnaire and then wait a few, sometimes weeks, before the insurance company would decide whether they were going to cover you. And then if they covered you, they might say, well, we're going to cover you, but we're not going to cover you for anything related to asthma. Now, in order to do that, in order to make the change we've made, that's meant that insurance companies have had to do things differently. So there are people on the Republican side who want to make it go back to the old way. And the way they want to do that and the reason they want to do that is because they think it'll be cheaper for healthier people to buy insurance if we don't have to cover pre-existing conditions for people who have them.
Got it. And is it true that the repeal, as we currently understand it, would mean that many more things are considered pre-existing conditions than currently are? Is that the case?
Here's how it would work. That's in effect what happens, but I want to make sure I'm accurate, and so I'm going to tell you what it actually says. What it actually says right now is that states would get to put in something with the federal government called a waiver. It would be at their option, so not every state would have to do it. But if they did it, the federal government would have to accept it. What that waiver would say is not whether or not a pre-existing condition needed to be covered, but whether or not the services that are provided by an insurance company need to be covered. So I'll give you an example. It would be illegal to say that you can't cover someone who has cancer. But it would be legal to say that you could not cover cancer services. So imagine someone who has cancer could buy a policy only to find out that things like chemotherapy and radiation and drugs that are only built for cancer aren't covered. So it's a backdoor way of not covering pre-existing conditions, and it allows them to go to the public and say, see, we didn't exclude people with pre-existing conditions, but they really did.
Wow, that is wild. I did not, in all the things I've read or heard, I'd not heard somebody explain it that way. That makes a lot more sense. And now it makes sense how Republicans are saying like, oh no, it does still cover the conditions. They are in essence telling that that is a true statement, but what is dishonest or misleading is that they're not covering the services that would actually treat the conditions. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, I call it a high five and a wink. Like they can high five and say, look, we got this done, but they can wink at each other and know what they what they've really accomplished. And I think it's a really disingenuous form of government.
Now, if I understand correctly, Medicaid is the single biggest thing on the chopping block with the repeal that we've seen. Is that right?
Yeah. So the biggest issue in the Senate is that there's a proposal in this bill that would cut 25% of Medicaid program over the next 10 years and 35% over the next 20 years. That is an enormous cut to this program that you and I have talked about on your podcast a few times before.
Andy, I also thought I read that now there's an effort to just repeal it and not replace it. Is that true?
That is true. That is something that happened over the last few days, and I should have mentioned it. It's unclear whether it's a veiled threat or whether it's reality, but Trump, using his Twitter thumbs, said that if the Senate is not able to repeal the ACA and replace it with the plan they're working on, that they ought to go ahead and repeal it and just replace it later. Now, I don't think we should take all that extremely seriously, because I think that takes our eye off the ball. I don't think that that has a lot of likelihood, because the Senate is not likely to do that. But I would say this, if that were to happen, the likelihood that there would ever be a replacement plan for the ACA would be very, very small.
What's to come, Andy? What should we be looking for this week? I worry that there's a fatigue that's happening with the conversation about healthcare, that one of the ways that the Republicans are sort of being able to wade this through is that people are just exhausted from hearing about it so much. So what should we be looking for as the week goes on?
Well, here's the good news. The good news is, one way or another, this isn't going to last. This, at least this phase of the battle, isn't going to last forever.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
They really have to have this voted on in the Senate by the end of July. And because it takes 2 weeks to get a score out of the CBO, that means that they really have to get this into the CBO by the end of this week. And, but sometime one way or the other, by the end of July, this will be, we'll be moving on to the next stage, which won't be over, but if I were to ask people to stay involved for just one more month and continue to stay focused for one more month through the course of July, that'll be incredibly helpful.
Cool. Thanks, Andy, and thanks for keeping us posted.
Thank you, DeRay.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
And here's the news with me, Clint Smith III, our resident academic, and Brittany Packnett, former member of the Ferguson Commission and appointed by President Obama to the Task Force on 21st Century Policing.
What's going on, y'all? This is Clint Smith at Clint Smith III on Twitter.
Hey, everyone. I'm Brittany Packnett, Miss Pacchetti on all social media.
And this is DeRay. It's great that we're all together. Clint, how old's the baby this week?
He's good. He's a month old. Family is coming in town periodically to help us out. And so it's good to give grandma and grandpa the morning shift, which is super helpful. But he's also in this sort of phase where he's cluster feeding. There's so many things about pregnancy and newborns and the entire process that you sort of don't hear in the sort of like popular discourse that you just kind of learn as you go. And I can say, I've talked to a couple people about this, but I've really never had more respect for single parents than I do now. I mean, it is absolutely astonishing and remarkable that single parents are able to raise a child and multiple children on their own. Because, you know, my partner and I, and even with the help of grandparents, it's something that keeps you up all night. And so I look at every single parent now and see them as a sort of superhero.
Ooh, have mercy. I saw on your Instagram, Clint, a picture of you with the baby swaddled to your chest. It was a grocery store cart in front of you, and you were like, ready, let's do this. And I was like, this is A, what real parenting looks like, and B, like I said on Instagram, how I hope you record the podcast every week.
He is right here. He's not right here. He would be right here, but his mom would be upset. But that's how you got to do it. That's how you got to be out here stunting at Trader Joe's. Stunt for the glam at Trader Joe's. That's the way to do it in 2017.
DeRay and I have been in your hometown of New Orleans, Louisiana this weekend. Not with baby strapped to our chest, although I hope one day that's my destiny. We were out here for Essence Fest. For those who don't know, Essence Magazine is one of the premier magazines in the African-American community, specifically catering to Black women and our needs, our struggles, our triumphs, our music, our fashion, our unity, our community. And it's a really amazing time. Chance the Rapper performed last night, which was a whole spiritual experience for me. It happened to be my late father's birthday. So I feel like if he were alive, my dad was a pastor, if he were alive, he would love Chance. And so I just very much felt him in that moment. But it's been a good weekend in the Big Easy.
Essence Fest is just so amazing because you have so many different musical acts and so many different folks who represent both a lot of contemporary folks who are out there in the music scene right now, but also a whole lot of people from back in the day who just bring you back to that nostalgic place. Like I remember I went to Essence last year, and that was the Bad Boy reunion tour was part of Essence Fest. And it was legit one of the best concerts I've ever been to. Like Faith Evans comes out and starts singing all these songs. You're like, oh snap, I've not heard this song in 15 years, but it is still a banger. And then, you know, 112 comes out, Peaches, and it was crazy.
Everybody should see Solange perform live at some point because she's just incredible. And Chance the Rapper, it's like a spiritual moment. I talked to Chance and hopefully we'll get him on the pod at some time soon. But let us go to the news now.
So, yeah. So speaking of Solange, I saw on Twitter there was a meme that somebody had of Solange coming out of the elevator and Jay-Z was behind her. And they said on this night, three classic albums were created, which I thought was very a very acute observation and very real, because who knows whether there will be a Lemonade or 444 or a seat at the table without that night that kind of brought the issues in the Carter world to the fore. So speaking of and thinking about Jay-Z, for those of you who have listened to Jay-Z's new album, which is incredible and very much lives up to a lot of the hype that has been around it, part of what a lot of folks have been discussing around Jay's work and what he talks about on the different tracks and on the different records is this notion of like creating intergenerational wealth, right? So Jay is reflecting on what it means to buy a piece of artwork that appreciates year by year by year, what it means to buy buildings, what it means to buy space, and what it means to create a sort of foundation of income and wealth that one can pass on to their children. And Jay raps about that very explicitly on many of those records. And so that had me thinking a lot about a lot of the sociological literature around intergenerational wealth, right? And so I always go, there's this one statistic that sort of is emblematic and captures the essence of the disparities that exist between Black folks and white folks with regard to wealth. And Sam was talking about this a little bit in the last podcast, but it's important to sort of disentangle and recognize the differences between income and wealth. And while there are drastic differences with regard to the income between Black folks and white folks and Latino folks, there's also an even greater canyon of space between Black folks and white folks with regard to wealth. And what captures that is at current growth rates, it would take Black Americans 228 years to have as much wealth as white Americans have today. And I don't think that people fully recognize that. And we talk about this sort of broadly all the time. But when I hear that number, I inevitably think of housing. And I inevitably think of so many of the sort of state-sanctioned public policy initiatives that have happened over the last several decades and the last couple centuries that have laid the foundation for intergenerational wealth for certain communities while stripping it from other communities. So an example I alluded to last podcast, but that I talk a lot about, is the New Deal, right? And so a lot about what we are sort of taught about the New Deal in our classrooms, in our American history classes growing up, and what I was taught in my American history class growing up, is that the New Deal is the most progressive series of legislative acts that have ever existed, that FDR signed these after the Depression, and it created the contemporary middle class and is responsible for the economic and social upward mobility of millions of Americans, which is true. What they don't tell you is that the very things and the very sort of pieces of social welfare and the social benefits and social programs that created that intergenerational wealth were not given to Black people, right? So Black people didn't have access to Social Security, minimum wage protection, housing mortgages, healthcare, GI Bill. And so what inevitably happens is that, you know, so they didn't, and they, what happened is they don't do it through a sort of explicit Black people do not, can't have Social Security. What they did was they recognized that Black people were disproportionately employed as farm workers and domestic workers, especially in the South. And they said, well, those are professions that won't receive the benefits of Social Security, or those are professions that won't receive the benefits of minimum wage protection. And they often gave the discretion of how to decide who got these social benefits to the state. And as we know from a wide and expansive history, the history of states' rights is often very much a pseudonym or a metonym for a set of insidious and sort of pernicious ways of stripping opportunities and stripping resources from Black folks. So all that to say, you know, what happens is if you have the very foundation of 20th century wealth and the very foundations of what created the middle class in the 20th century, and you don't give that to a specific demographic of people, it is inevitable that across generations and generations and generations, the residue of that decision and the series of those decisions will inevitably impact the generations following, right? So it's always strange to me when people make these kind of statements about like, oh, well, that happened, you know, years ago, or slavery is over, or the New Deal was 100 years ago, or whatever, not reckoning with the sort of larger intergenerational implications of what it means to not give somebody the opportunity to buy a house, or what it means not to give somebody the opportunity to have Social Security, or what it means not to give somebody the foundation upon which people can build homes and communities and the sort of large scale opportunities that afford young people to have a better life than their parents did.
Yeah, everything you're talking about is so critical, especially the acknowledgement of how much people are willing to ignore the truth of history, the kind of financial regulations and racist financial regulations that you're talking about, how much people are willing to ignore that those were actually a thing and just simply say, right, the people are supposed to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And I think that is emblematic of the broader conversation we have to have about the broader conversation we have to have that roots our current reality in the truth of history. You know, the American Enterprise Institute, which is a think tank, a conservative think tank out of D.C., tweeted today, they were paraphrasing a speech from President Calvin Coolidge, saying that, you know, America was not a place that was founded on, to use their words, blood or ethnicity, but was rather founded on ideas. And I'm like, I believe that African Americans and American Indians or Native Americans would fundamentally disagree with you. But this willingness to ignore what really happened because it didn't happen to your people or because it is not your cultural legacy is not only problematic, right? And we joke about it on Twitter and the social media spaces, but it's really dangerous. It teaches people that if you do not enjoy the kind of generational wealth that you're talking about, Clint, that it is somehow your own fault, right? That you were lazy, that it is your fault that you do not have access to that kind of capital, that it must be your family's fault. And that is how we continue to decrease people's humanity. And we build policy and entire structures based on those ideas. And so the insidious nature of what you're talking about, I believe, permeates a lot of things in our culture and in our society. And I know that we often joke about it, but it really, really is dangerous.
It is interesting too, you know, when I think about this, I'm reminded of a couple of things. One is that this is intentional. Like, people are poor and are living in deep poverty, not because of a series of bad choices that they made often, but it is because of a series of choices that were made by people in power that limited the choices that they could make. And I think that that perspective is really important. The second is that when giving context to the racial wealth gap is Demos did a study of 2011 data, and what they showed is that the median white household had $111,000 in wealth holdings compared to just $7,000 for the median Black household and about $8,000 for the median Latino household. So the disparity is so huge. And what people don't realize is that the single biggest asset that most people ever have is a home. So when Clint, you talk about like the history of redlining and loans for houses as like a wrong, you know, people hear that and sort of gloss over it, but it is, I don't know a way right now to give people context for understanding the magnitude of houses as assets, especially when we think about intergenerational wealth.
100%. I mean, I think that there is, as you said, there's no single larger asset that an American family can have than a home. And this operates sort of insidiously on two fronts, right? So one, through the history of redlining, through the history of zoning policy, Black people have not been given the opportunity to even buy homes in the first place, like Black people with means, right? So we're not talking about poor Black folks who couldn't afford a home. We're talking about middle-class Black folks who wanted to buy homes in certain neighborhoods where the value of the house would appreciate over the course of years and years and decades weren't allowed to buy those homes for at a long period of time. And in many ways, it's still happening now, right? It doesn't get as much attention, but we know that housing discrimination is still deeply profound. And that's one of the dangers of having someone like Ben Carson, who believes that poverty is the result of a mindset in charge of the HUD, because he has a very sort of ahistoric conception of what poverty looks like and how people end up living in poverty. So one, a lot of folks can't even purchase homes in the first place because of discrimination. But for those who can purchase homes, there's sort of study after study after study that demonstrates that the homes that Black people are able to get mortgages for, the homes that Black people are able to move into, don't appreciate at the same rate that homes in more affluent and white neighborhoods do, even though those same Black folks could afford the home in the place where the housing value would appreciate more and more. So I think talking about housing is essential. Another thing I wanted to say was all three of us are educators and have been educators in both traditional and non-traditional classroom context. And part of what I think we often talk about, oh, white people don't understand this and it has these sets of implications. I think that is definitely true. I also think that we don't really reckon with what it means for a young person to grow up being told their entire lives that the reason that their community looks the way that it does is because of the people in that community, and not getting their own and not being told that the reason that this community looks the way that it does and the people in your community live the way that they do is because of decades and decades of like specific state-sanctioned public policy and decisions that people made to prioritize certain neighborhoods and not prioritize yours. And I think that I remember there's this one time where a student came up to me and he was like, that's just how it is here, Mr. Smith. Like, that's just how things are. And they internalize that, right? Because that's what the world is telling them day after day. And so, you know, if people aren't sharing with them that actually the reason that there are no grocery stores here, or the reason that all the homes are dilapidated, or the reason that there's so much violence is because of decades of decisions made by politicians and policymakers that major schools and major community centers and major homes look that way, we're purposeful, right? But if we're not telling them, if we're not sharing that with our students, then they grow up in these contexts where they come to internalize sometimes the very pathologies that we're often fighting against, because they don't have the sort of language or understanding to push back against that.
What about people who are saying that in the spirit of like, I'm going to tell you that this is yours so that you can fix it, as opposed to sort of offloading things to some big brother? And when it's offloaded to big brother, that there seems to be less room for individual agency. Like, what would you say to people who sort of push on what you said in that way?
So I don't think that a recognition of structural and systemic reality that has shaped the contemporary landscape of Black communities is mutually exclusive from a recognition of agency, right? I don't think, and if anything, I think it gives people more agency, because I think that they then recognize that this is not reflective of a cultural pathology that they have been told about themselves and about their communities oftentimes, and is instead, these are decisions that were made by people who, and if you do that with a sort of nuanced pedagogy of understanding power and like how power operates, and that, you know, the world is a social construction, and thus it can be reconstructed and deconstructed and made into something new. So I don't necessarily see those two things in tension. I agree with you that I think sometimes people can use it in a way that is sort of nefarious, and sometimes people can use it in a way that makes it suggest that, oh, well, you know, it's the man and there's nothing we can do about it. But I don't actually think that that is reflective of what engaging in a sort of broader understanding of the history that have made certain parts of this country look one way and certain parts of this community look the other way. And I mean, people have done this. You all know that folks have done this extensively with Ferguson and St. Louis over the course of the past 3 or 4 years, right? Where people are saying the reason that Ferguson looked the way that it did, and the reason that the police force operated the way that it did, and that people lived in the conditions that they did, was not reflective of the people in Ferguson or like a culture that existed there or genetic phenomena. It was instead because politicians in Missouri made a set of decisions over the course of many, many years that shaped the landscape of different cities and municipalities in that space. And so yeah, I don't necessarily believe that those things are in tension. I think that we can only, I think one sort of is regains a sense of agency, if you will, once they are given a broader set of information as to why the world looks the way that it does.
I think that's critically important, right? Discussing systemic issues does not negate individual agency. Rather, it enables individual agency, right? Now I am working full contact with a full deck of cards instead of being forced to play the hand that I was dealt. And I think that level of consciousness, especially as, like you said, as educators, it's something that's critical to impart on young people, but on everyone as we try to increase individual agency, right? The other point that I wanted to make, you brought up Ben Carson. And if we go back to this idea that people readily ignore the systemic history of oppression in this country in order to justify their looking down on of other people, I'm often reminded that individual success does not prove anything, right? And that an exception does not prove the rule. So, you know, we heard this when people said, well, Barack Obama is president, so clearly we don't live in a racist country. one black man or biracial man, as it were, in the White House does not erase decades of history, just like Hillary Clinton coming very close to the White House does not erase decades of sexism. And often people look to people like Ben Carson, and I believe that he has fallen into this trap too. And they said, if Ben Carson can do it, anyone can do it. Instead of recognizing that systems of oppression hold entire communities back. And again, an exception does improve the rule. But I agree. I think that that level of consciousness gives people an increased amount of agency and not less.
And I think that your point around that is really important, because the systems of oppression necessitate that there are people who are exceptions to the rule in order for folks to point to those people as a means to justify the existence of a system that otherwise oppresses the vast majority of folks. So, you know, whether it's white supremacy, whether it's patriarchy, whether it's, you know, heterosexism, whether it's all of these things necessitate that there are people who sort of make it through the cracks, so that folks who are complicit or are direct participants in that oppression can say, look, Obama is president. Look, Oprah makes all that money. Look, Hillary was almost president. And you can use all of those to justify what we otherwise know as like a deeply oppressive overall system.
I think we should, this makes me think about a couple of things, and Clint, we need to go to your second piece of news, but I definitely am going to get an expert on housing so that we can talk about this a little bit more around what it means to have assets. Clint and Brittany, I am this, you know, we haven't talked about this offline, so we're having it for the first time here. I think you're right about this idea of like the exception as a necessary component. I think that's fascinating. Brittany, and this idea that the exception doesn't prove the rule. And I think that you both really artfully helped explain that we can acknowledge systemic wrongdoing while also like giving people agency, because what we know to be true is that one of the ways that oppression works, right, is that it performs this innocence that's like, we didn't mean to do it, didn't plan for it to have the impact that it has, but you should just be thankful that we are acknowledging right now that we can move forward without acknowledging the past trauma. So we can acknowledge a historical trauma without taking away from the agency that people have. And I think that makes a lot of sense. We should continue that. So Clint, you're number two.
Yeah, definitely. I just want to give a couple book recommendations for folks who are interested in thinking about this more. I would say Ira Katz Nelson, who's a historian and political scientist at Columbia University, wrote a book called When Affirmative Action Was White that outlines the racist history of the New Deal. There is a book that just came out called The Color of Law that sort of has a deeply comprehensive outline of the history of housing discrimination in the United States. And then there's a book called Black Wealth, White Wealth that sort of analyzes how the history of Black inequality and white inequality are vastly different because they stem from vastly different places. All three of those have been really important sociological and historical texts for me in thinking about a lot of these issues, and I think they would definitely be helpful for any of our listeners. So the second piece of news that I have has to do with it's sort of been in the news for the past couple months, but has resurfaced for me, is this idea that because of the sort of renewed draconian policies around immigration, the levels of reporting around domestic violence, around rape, and around other sorts of crimes that directly affect women and children have gone down in Latino communities. And a lot of folks are attributing that directly to the fact that people are afraid to report if their partner is abusing them or if someone is abusing their children because they're afraid to involve themselves at all in the governmental system, right? To have their information documented in that way. If they are not an authorized citizen, they fear that they'll go in to say, my partner is beating me, and will end up being deported as a result. And I think, you know, part of there's so much noise happening with the Trump administration, but we can't forget the sort of side effects of many of the policies and the sort of cultural shifts that are taking place in a lot of these departmental agencies that are like deeply affecting people's lives every single day, right? There are women and children who are forced to stay in the homes of their abusers because they are afraid that if they go report them, they will be deported. And that is so frightening. And that is so scary. And I recently had the opportunity to sit down with several undocumented young people in Maryland. And part of what I thought was really interesting and really unsettling was we often have this sort of discussion in Black communities about the quote unquote talk, right? Like the talk that Black parents have to give their children around how to navigate a world that is often taught to fear them. And something that I hadn't fully considered was that in the undocumented community, there's its own sort of iteration of the talk. And I was talking with these young people, and they were talking about how when they've turned, 9, 10, 11 years old, their parents started having conversations with them saying, if one of us are deported, you need to go to your aunt's house. You need to go to your friend's house. Don't let them. And if somebody asks you if you knew who we were, say you don't. And so there's almost this sort of, in the same way that there's a fire escape plan, right, for students at a school, there's almost a plan that like young undocumented folks have to understand if one of their parents or guardians or siblings get deported, and the entire infrastructure of that plan is centered on making sure that ICE can't get to other people connected to that person. So you have folks who are taught to not acknowledge their mother or their father, or to say they don't know those people. And that's something that intuitively makes a lot of sense, but that I hadn't necessarily considered as a fundamental component of what it means to grow up and maintain a sense of safety when you're an undocumented young person.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in my full-time work supporting undocumented teachers and students and figuring out how institutions can better stand by them in support of some just brilliant people I have on my team leading that work. And I was with a principal in Dallas, Texas, of an elementary school, a white man, who took that a step further to your point, Clint, about this kind of fire escape plan, right? Or this plan that you have to have in these circumstances, and took that a step further and said, how do we as an institution make sure that we help young people actualize whatever plan their family needs to have in place for them? And so we essentially created a set of documents, folders, for family members to leave in a trusted and safe place, information about where their child should go if for some reason they are deported, what their medications are, who to emergency contacts if the parents are not there, et cetera, et cetera. And he caught a lot of flack for that, which I found fascinating because, not fascinating, unfortunately unsurprising, but I found that awful because this is not a political conversation, right? We are talking about the fundamental safety of children. And what sickens me is how much people politicize that matter and how much people refuse to acknowledge the humanity and the humane need for safety for a child based on their citizenship or their parents' status. Or the child's race or their first language. And so that has been frustrating to see, but it's been also empowering to see how many folks who in particular lead institutions, whether it be a school or a university or a place of employment, who are figuring out all of the ways aside from policy to actually create alternative systems, information systems to keep people protected and keep people safe. Which, again, is not a political issue. It's an issue of humanity.
I didn't know that this was a talk that was happening in the undocumented community. So that is new to me. It is a reminder, too, about the way that the federal government like bears onto people's lives. There was so much rhetoric happening during the election, again, about this idea that like the federal government doesn't matter, that like it's everything's local. And what we know to be true is that's actually not the case. What this makes me think about the most is sort of unrelated to the issue directly, but there's so many people who are like, one of the good things that happened because of Trump, this idea that we should be praising the level of activism that has happened and the level of organizing, the level of mobilizing. And I get the intent. I am also mindful that people are mobilizing and they're activists and they're organizers because of a response to trauma, and that the response to trauma shouldn't be there in the first place. So I'm always like cautious about how people are like excited about the energy in this moment, because I know that the excitement, that it's not excitement, it's like necessity. It is urgent because it's real people's lives impacted. Like, I wasn't excited to get tear gas. I wasn't excited to sit in jail. Did those things because they were important and necessary in those moments and continue to be. And when I think about conversations that happen, like the talk in undocumented families, like parents aren't excited to do that. They aren't like, you know, people aren't waking up being like, let me put together this binder for when my family gets separated. Like that's not a joyful thing, even if people do it well. They're doing it in response to trauma, and we should focus our energy on making sure there's no more trauma. And I've been wrestling with that in my own spaces, because so many people are like, oh, I'm just so excited about all the energy. And I'm like, you know, I would love to be excited about not having to put this energy into this work, because there wouldn't be trauma.
Yeah. We've often said about protests, we do this because we have to, not because we want to. And I think it's the same is true here. I also worry about what happens when the energy fades, because we tend to have short attention spans. And what happens when the energy around solving problems, supporting people, standing in solidarity with people fades, and families are still suffering? The problems tend not to disappear just because our attention has.
And I was talking about this with a friend the other day, but I think that a sort of case study in that in many ways was the election of Barack Obama, right? I think back in 2008, there was so much excitement and energy, and this sort of, in many ways, what felt like a sort of unprecedented mobilization, especially of young people, around electing the first Black president and electing this person who really represented in many folks' minds the ideals and values that we all espouse and that we all stood for and want in, represented in the federal government. I think what happened, and some political theorists have written about this a bit, but all of the sort of organizing and protest energy that sort of existed around more issue-specific phenomena was sort of all coalesced around him. And once we elected Barack Obama, a lot of people took their foot off the gas. I was a college junior at the time, and so I sort of include myself and make myself complicit in what it meant to like put a lot of energy into electing this person and then projecting all of my ideals onto him, rather than recognizing that what was actually necessary was like, okay, now this person who is amenable to ideas that are and values that matter to us, now you have to sort of ramp up the pressure, right? And so part of what I think the last several years have been with the Movement for Black Lives, with Fight for 15, and with union work is a recognition that that the work of protest sort of necessarily needs to evolve, and one can't simply doesn't have the luxury of saying like once this one thing is done, once this one initiative is done, or once this one person is in office or what have you, that you can sort of take your foot off the gas. And I think unfortunately now we're in a moment where the unfortunate necessity of protest and making the, in this moment, like the very real implications of destroying the Affordable Care Act, bringing that to the attention of people through protest, as you guys always say, protest is telling the truth in public, right? And so I think it's essential to bring that to people's attention. But even if we first stop the Affordable Care Act from being repealed, the energy around it can't stop there. And I hope that, you know, that's something that I'm always trying to remind myself of, that the this work is ongoing, even when it's not popular, even when it's not sexy, even when it is exhausting and it's the last thing you want to do. Those are almost the moments in which it needs to be done the most.
So for my two pieces of news, things that are very thought-provoking for me, the first of which I'm not necessarily an expert in, but I think it's an important piece of news that could probably get lost in the shuffle of lots of things that have been happening this week. In British Columbia, the government there has issued a health card for the first baby ever without a specified gender in that space. The baby's parent is also gender nonconforming and is similarly fighting for that to be marked on the birth certificate. Apparently, that's a very uphill climb. But the parent wants to, quote, raise the baby in such a way that until they have a sense of self and command of vocabulary to tell me who they are, I'm recognizing them as a baby and trying to give them all the love and support to be the most whole person they can be outside of the restrictions that come with the boy box and the girl box. And so, like, I am cisgender. So I recognize that privilege, but I wanted to amplify a story that I think is critically important. We often talk about how language evolves. And I wouldn't say that gender identities have evolved, but rather our recognition of them is hopefully evolving. And so I'm hoping to, that this is something that can continue to evolve, and that our understanding of gender and gendering of children is something that can move forward with thoughtfulness and care for people.
This is interesting and something that, as a new father, I think a lot about. I think, what does it mean to, what sort of ideas, what sort of language, what sort of values and notions around sex and gender and sexual orientation am I presenting my son with? And how am I ensuring that he grows up both with a recognition of systems of patriarchy and systems of sexism and systems that often force people to conform and perform in specifically gendered ways. And so to give him that recognition, and then also to share with him that is not the expectation that his mother and I have of him, right? So it's interesting thinking, trying to be thoughtful and purposeful about raising a young person to try to think differently about gender in a way that is not so so specifically demarcated and so specifically binary in the ways that we often think about it, right? And so just to make sure that we are continuously educating ourselves, as both his mother and I are cishet folks, thinking of what does it mean to just be thoughtful and be full of making sure that the conversations are full of empathy, and what books are we presenting him with, what folks are you know, what music, what I mean, and you, the more you start to think about this, the more you realize the ways that our entire society is set up upon these like very binary notions of gender, and how can we as responsible parents sort of complicate that notion a little bit.
It's a reminder that people are doing the work of expanding what we understand options to be everywhere across the country, like that it's happening. And some of this is about making sure that we know what's happening so that we can replicate it in other places. And I think that this is an example of like broadening people's scope and understanding in a practical way and not just a theoretical way. So we've been talking about gender identity for a long time in the literature and in the academy. And this is that transition from thought to action at scale, like at the state level. And I think that that's actually really powerful for activists and organizers and citizens to help replicate. B?
Yeah, the only other thing that I'll say is this has me also reflecting on not just actual gender identities and the binary that exists there, but the toxicity of traditional masculinity and femininity as we've been presenting it. So I remember the first time I ever saw a young person in my life dressed up for Halloween as Doc McStuffins, who, you don't have kids and you don't know about the character, is a young Black girl who I think is like basically like plays doctor like on her pets or her stuffed animals. I don't have kids, but I don't know all the story life. But I was just very excited to see all these little Black girls excited to run around and be a doctor. Not just because I want little Black kids to be whatever they want to be, but also this idea that yes, as a young woman, you can dress up as princesses, but you can also dress up as a soccer player or as a doctor or whatever. And that, you know, like, you know, as a man, if you want to wear a romp pin, then like, if you feel good in it, then great. Like, for me, it is not just about gender binaries. Obviously, that is a critical conversation. That's why I brought up this article. But more broadly, the stereotypes of masculinity and femininity that we just indoctrinate children with at such a young age. I'm hopeful that we continue to expand those definitions. My second piece of news is something that I do have a bit more of an opinion about. So according to many news sources, the residents of Sally Hemings, who was enslaved on the Monticello plantation by Thomas Jefferson, and who bore many of Thomas Jefferson's children. There are literally hundreds of descendants of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings that have lived in this country. That residence was found. One of the things that I really appreciate about this story is that it is evidence of why diversity in all fields matters. So it was a number of Black historians and archaeologists that helped make this important discovery. And without people who have a particular affinity for and or care about a lot of the lost pieces of history that have to do with marginalized people, we will not discover these kinds of things. But I have two qualms with the way this has been being reported. NBC News used the word mistress when reporting this story. So it said Thomas Jefferson's mistress, Sally Hemings, secret quarters finally discovered. One is that the secret quarters were not in fact quarters. It was a windowless room that was very near where Thomas Jefferson slept. And so that brings me to my second frustration, which is the use of the word mistress is wholly inappropriate here. I know that this conversation was had by folks like Angela Ryan, Simone Sanders, who are dear sister friends of mine, when Bill Mayer used the N-word in respect to the enslavement of our ancestors. And they reminded Bill that actually there is a deeply insidious history, not just to that word, but to this idea of being a house nigger, to use the correct phrase. For me, this feels as problematic and is, quite frankly, as a Black woman, deeply painful, because Sally Hemings was not a mistress, right? A mistress is someone who engages in a consensual relationship with a married man of their own volition and of their own agency. Enslaved people did not have agency in the way that a mistress does. That is not to say that enslaved people did not exercise whatever agency they possibly could, and it's important to recognize that. But it is deeply offensive and problematic to think of Sally Hemings or the thousands of Black women that were in Sally Hemings' position, whose names we don't know all across this country and throughout history, to be addressed as a mistress, because she wasn't. She was raped. She was forced into the positions that she was in. And I think I wanted to bring that up because I think it's a teachable moment for us to think about the language that we choose, to think about the choices that we make and how we report things. I'm glad to see that her room is going to be restored and that her presence in that space of Monticello is not going to continue to be ignored. And I'm thankful to her descendants who have been pushing for her recognition for a number of years. But let me be very clear. I'm going to need all the news outlets to stop using the word mistress when you are talking about enslaved Black women who were forcibly raped by their slave owners. Period. End of story. We should not be making this mistake anymore in 2017.
So I've been rereading this book, The Half Has Never Been Told, by Cornell University historian Ed Baptist. And it's an incredible piece of historical literature, and I recommend it to everyone. It's largely talking about the role of the relationship between capitalism and slavery, and debunking the notion that some seek to espouse that slavery was actually bad for capitalism, and that the U.S. economy, as we understand it today, was not built on the institution of slavery. And so he kind of debunks that piece by piece. But part of what he discusses in the book, which I think is really important and touches on what Brittany is discussing, is the way that we fail to discuss what actually took place with regard to the relationship between white slaveholders and Black enslaved people, Black enslaved women. And that, you know, he talks about young white slaveholders going down to New Orleans to purchase Black women with the explicit purpose of, like, making them their sexual objects, right? And tools for their own sexual experiences. And I don't, that for me was not really ever part or central to the discussion around slavery when I was growing up. Like it felt very peripheral if discussed at all, but like the institution of slavery fundamentally sort of encouraged white men to exercise sexual domination over black women for centuries. And I don't think that we have fully as a society like reckoned with that, reckoned with the implications of that, and reckoned with what that means for how we think about the case, a case like Sally Hemings, right? Like, what does it mean for this black woman to have given birth to so many of Thomas Jefferson's children? And how can we more fully account for it's coercion is not even the right word, but like what it means for her to literally be that man's property, right? Like how can we even begin to conceive of a sexual or romantic relationship in the context of someone owning another person or even someone buying another person with the specific intention of using them in that sort of way? So, obviously I agree with Brittany around the way that the sort of nomenclature that's being used around Sally Hemings. I hope we use it as an opportunity to think more deeply around the ways that we discuss how black enslaved women were used in horrific ways for the benefit of white men in ways that we're often not comfortable discussing.
Now I go to my first piece of news is about marijuana. So in DC, they just passed, the city council just advanced legislation that would give local minority-owned companies a preference when applying for licenses to open medical marijuana businesses. So as we know, black people were disproportionately targeted during the war on drugs, and so many people are in jail for low-level drug offenses and in jail for a very long time, whether it's for weed or other drugs. And there are cities across the country that are accounting for that in the context of the legalization of selling marijuana, using marijuana, by making sure that licenses are being held for people of color, right? That it is deeply unfair that suddenly in 2017, where the science hasn't changed so much, but weed is suddenly socially acceptable, that now there's so many people who spent forever in jail, so they would be out of the market. And that these laws help put people back in the game and in the legal game. So DC has moved forward. The mayor hasn't signed it yet, but has said that she is going to work with the city council on it. And I didn't know, and what I learned recently is that Oakland has actually gone further, Oakland, California, and they specifically set aside half of all business permits for marijuana for people arrested for drug crimes in the city or who come from neighborhoods with many drug arrests. So that is one of the most progressive ways that this has been accounted for. And then other states like Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Florida have taken steps to give preferences to minority marijuana entrepreneurs. And Maryland actually just entertained a law that would have done this too, but it failed. So there's some legal action pending right now in the courts that'll probably go up in July around diversity with the marijuana regulators in Maryland. But that's sort of the state of where we are with that issue. And I thought that was so interesting because I didn't know that was happening.
Yeah, the ACLU had a really important report a few years ago that was sort of outlining the large sort of disparities with regard to the treatment in the criminal justice system of marijuana along racial lines. And you know, we know these statistics, a lot of us know these statistics. And I talked in my first appearance on the podcast about how these statistics can often be used in ways that run counter to the ways that we think they'll be used or perceived. But I still think that we need to understand these numbers regardless. But, you know, so for example, black folks are almost four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession as compared to their white counterparts, even though all of the data suggests that the use of marijuana is equal between the two. We know that between 2001 and 2010, the cost of enforcing marijuana laws was $3.6 billion a year. And you know, with the constant discussion around how we're in a deficit and budget slashing that has happened throughout states and at the federal level for the past several years, you know, we can come up with a myriad of different ways that that money can be used. So, you know, again, to bring it back to the Jay-Z album, I don't remember which record it is, but he has a track where he's talking about this exact thing, where he's talking about, you know, now that kids in Colorado can smoke weed, you know, white folks are founding these and starting these weed dispensaries that are and selling the very thing that put, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young Black folks in the criminal justice system. So I think that the work that DC is doing on this is an important recognition of an opportunity for a local government to step in and make sure that the folks who have been disproportionately affected by the criminalization of marijuana also have an opportunity to benefit from its existence as a part of the legalized market.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add is I, you know, believe this ties back to what you were saying in the very beginning, Clint, about generational wealth and about all of the insidious ways in which marginalized communities and people of color were boxed out of wealth-making opportunities, wealth-building opportunities. I know we keep saying we're going to have a conversation about capitalism, and we absolutely should. But while it is the law of the land, so to speak, participation and access by marginalized communities and by people of color is a critical conversation to be had, and it's critical to ensure. And so, yes, the ways in which we either intentionally secure access for all people or intentionally restrict access for marginalized people, as has been happening in this industry thus far, will lead to the exact same kind of outcomes that we were talking about in the very beginning of this segment. I think the other thing, though, is that that is emblematic of what all of these conversations are about. When we're talking about issues of racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, and how they manifest in people's real lives as a result of policy, I think people want to see a law that is written that says no Black people can or no trans people can. And unfortunately, plenty of laws are written like that right now. I mean, the bathroom bill is a perfect example. But that is not how politics works. People are smarter than that. And so I just want to encourage folks to look at all of the ways in which policy is applied in real life versus exactly what the letter of the law says, and how the letter of the law is used to pervert equity and justice for people as you explore issues like everything from transportation in your city and where train lines run and where public transportation doesn't run, to the legalization of marijuana and who is allowed to participate in that industry and who cannot.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Brittany, Clint, there we go.
Thanks, y'all.
Appreciate it.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
And now, my conversation with Senator Schatz from Hawaii.
Senator Schatz, I'm excited for you to join me today on Pod Save the People.
Thanks, DeRay. Thanks for having me. I love your show.
Appreciate it. So you are one of the senators from Hawaii.
I am.
Can you talk to us about how you got to the Senate? before we talk about the issues of the day?
So I was a community organizer in the environmental space right out of college. I grew up in Hawaii, kind of concerned with the natural environment as a lot of local kids are. And I just knew, I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but the one thing I wanted to focus on was Hawaii's environment. So I came home from college in Southern California, and I started a nonprofit organization designated to get young people involved in community service for the environment. And I didn't really know what I was doing, except that I had this instinct that kids wanted to help and that organizations could actually use their help. And so I just sort of became a connector. I would go to schools and talk about Hawaii's environmental problems. And then I would go to organizations and talk about what they needed in terms of, you know, physical help, trail maintenance, you know, planting trees, stuff in the ocean, whatever needed to be done in Hawaii's environment. And it kind of took off, and it was going really well for 4 or 5 years. And some of that work took me to the Hawaii legislature. And that was when I started to realize that, you know, in a lot of instances, especially environmentally, things were happening literally upstream that were about policy, that were not so much things that I could solve on my own with my two hands or even with, you know, several dozen high school kids. And so I kind of had a long conversation with my dad about it, and he encouraged me to run for the legislature, but I was 25. And he sort of pushed me through the challenge of being too young to run for the legislature. And I just kind of went for it. I wore out 3 pairs of shoes, knocked on every door, and won by 400 votes. And I've been in politics ever since, organized for Barack Obama in 2008 and served as Democratic Party chairman and lieutenant governor, and then was sort of unexpectedly elevated to the Senate when the late, great Danny Noy passed away. But, you know, as you know, DeRay, you sort of can't pick your timing, and here I am.
And your father, I just learned this, your father was involved in uncovering the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. Is that correct?
That's right. You know, so my dad was a physician, taught internal medicine, and, you know, he was right out of college, or right out of medical school, I should say. And he read about the Tuskegee experiments, you know, where they withheld penicillin from African-American sharecroppers. For the purpose of, and I always put this in quote, observing the disease process. They withheld curative medicine from Americans. And this was a study that was actually paid for by the federal government. And my dad found it to be wrong and wrote a letter to the authors of the study and to the journal that he read about it in. And you know, it was sort of a small act in a lot of ways, but what I think is shocking is that he was the only doctor at the time that went on the record. A couple of years later, there were some media investigatory efforts, and what happened was this became a matter of national interest, and eventually, you know, in the early 70s, Tom Harkin and others banned the withholding of medicine from anybody for research purposes. You know, for me, thinking about my dad, what shocks me is he never told me that story until I was, you know, a grown man. Because for him, it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, you just sort of do the right thing, and you move on. And maybe somebody notices, and maybe somebody doesn't. But I didn't know that he had played any role in that dark period in American history until I was probably late 20s.
Now, in terms of being in the Senate, this is an incredible time to be in Congress. I can only imagine, given the state of turmoil in this administration. How would you just sort of broadly describe what it's like to be on the inside? I can talk a lot about what it's like to be on the outside, but what is it like to be one of a handful of people who sits in such an incredible role?
Well, you know, when Donald Trump won, I was in my living room with my wife and my 13-year-old and my 9-year-old, and I just looked at him and I said, you know, my job just got a lot less fun and a lot more important because of the rules of the Senate. that require bipartisanship, we are really the tip of the spear in terms of trying to prevent the worst from happening, at least in terms of lawmaking. There are a lot of things that Donald Trump can do from the executive branch. There's a lot of harm that he does in terms of international relations and in terms of setting a sort of toxic tone nationally. But in terms of preventing him from enacting laws that would harm people, it's the Senate Democrats. And that's what I've been focusing on. And I think all of us feel that way. We feel, you know, on a day-to-day level, it is a lot less joyful, but also there's joy in the fight. And I'll tell you that the one aspect of this that is, you know, the silver lining is the resistance. Nobody has ever seen anything like this.
What do you say to people who say that the Democrats aren't organized in their resistance on the inside, or that the Republicans are just walking all over it, even though they have the majority, that there are things that the Democrats could do, like with the nuclear option that seems to be coming up, that you all could overwhelm them with amendments, but that doesn't seem to be the public strategy? What's your response to those critiques?
Well, look, I think we ought to use every bit of leverage that we have. And I also think that there's no preponderance of wisdom in Washington, D.C. in terms of strategy or tactics. I think we've learned that from the 2016 election, you know, both on the Senate side and in terms of the Clinton campaign. We learned that, hey, there are a lot of really smart thinkers in politics that are at the grassroots level, that may be at the state level, that may be just, you know, sitting there on Twitter ruminating about what our strategy should be. You know, we're not going to necessarily reveal all of our tactics, but the main leverage that any individual senator has is to withhold his or her unanimous consent. Everything runs on what you call UC, unanimous consent. You can't so much as schedule a hearing or convene without unanimous consent. And, you know, listen, if you start to get into withholding unanimous consent for nonsense reasons, then the Senate breaks down and the country breaks down. But there's a reason that each senator has that authority, and it's for times like this. It's for moments like this when you have the Republicans doing something so extraordinary, so mean-spirited, so cruel to so many millions of Americans in secret. You know, it's time for us to fight back with extraordinary measures. I don't know how that manifests itself. I think it's important for us to maintain some, you know, sort of tactical flexibility as we go into this week. I think there's a reasonable shot that the public pressure on some of the more moderate Republican senators will be the thing that does the trick. However, if Mitch McConnell goes through with this, and it looks like they're going to, you know, try to jam us and jam the American people with a health care bill that's polling and, you know, around 15% and is going to, you know, wreak havoc on American lives, then I think we've got to do every single thing at our disposal. And those are the conversations going on over the next couple of days.
What's your take on the Russian involvement in the elections and the investigation by Mueller?
Well, I'm confident in Mueller. I do think that, you know, that normally if a gadfly says something about firing a special counsel, you would sort of dismiss it and say, well, that's a gadfly. He's, you know, talking out loud about dismissing a special counsel. But in this administration, the gadflies are often the political and strategic center of gravity. So I take it very seriously that there is a real possibility that the president will try to intervene with Attorney General Rosenstein and get him to fire Mueller. To be clear, the way the law works, only Rosenstein can fire Mueller. But, you know, he could certainly execute what was done in the Watergate era, a sort of Saturday night massacre, where he will essentially fire people until he finds someone who's willing to dismiss Mueller. I do think that would be a bridge too far, even for Republicans. And there is at least quiet talk about if that actually happened, we'd likely go ahead and enact a statute, which would be a special prosecutor. And the person that we would hire is Bob Mueller. So I feel, you know, listen, I feel confident that that he's the best investigator in the country for this purpose, and he's got great bipartisan credentials. You know, one other point I just want to make, DeRay, even though you didn't necessarily ask about it, people are perfectly capable of thinking about healthcare and thinking about the rule of law at the same time, or at least in the same day or week. For me, it's a little bit of a false choice. You know, in the Senate, you know, I'm on multiple committees, and every day I'm thinking about commerce and ethics and appropriations and, you know, energy and civil justice. And I understand that's my profession, but I think the people are engaged enough and educated enough and care enough that we shouldn't have to choose between the operation of law and the rule of law and fighting for the healthcare for Americans. I think we got to do both. And for that matter, I think we have to continue to fight for civil justice, and we have to continue to fight for climate action.
Now, you all have been summoned to the White House twice, I believe, right? All of the senators?
There was a cocktail party, and I had something scheduled. I'm not sure if there was another. No, there was. There was a briefing on North Korea. And I have to say, it was a valid enough briefing. It was a good briefing, but it was an extraordinary and pretty unusual thing to have 100 members of the Senate, you know, ride over on buses with a motorcade, you know, to the executive office building. They had to create a secure facility because they don't have one that big. The only secure facility that can fit 100 members is the Senate facility. And there's, you know, you could have just dragged the three people who were briefing us over rather than have 100 of us go over there. And the only reason I mention that is that it made us feel like the whole thing was for PR rather than for, you know, a proper security briefing.
And what about Comey in this moment? Do you think that hearing was a pivotal hearing in this whole sort of saga that's happening with Trump? Did it make you think anything different about him or the senior levels of the administration?
So I think there's two ways to look at the Comey hearing. I mean, for insiders, I think, you know, a lot of people said, well, he didn't break a lot of new ground. And, you know, they're sort of looking for the news, right? They're looking for the new facts or the new fact pattern. But somebody, you know, described it to me in the following way, and I think it makes sense. You know, it's sort of like, you know, most Americans are sort of dropping into like the sixth episode of Homeland this season, and they haven't watched the first five. And Comey is a storyteller. And Comey is capable of organizing his thoughts and the sort of sequence of events in such a way. And he's such a compelling figure just on television. The guy, you know, really knows how to perform and has a lot of credibility. I think he was beyond inexcusable in terms of releasing derogatory information in the last election. But I don't think he did it nefariously. I don't think he was lying. I just think he had a lapse in judgment. So he's a credible guy, and he told the story. And I think for the vast majority of Americans, it was the moment where they said, wow, this thing is really serious. And now I see sort of how the sequence of events is increasingly, you know, pointing in one direction. And the way I would characterize it is, you know, for the folks who have lives to live and don't, you know, follow this day to day on Twitter and don't have time to necessarily read everything about it, it is increasingly clear that this is what it looks like. It is increasingly clear that that the president has attempted to interfere with an investigative process. Now, whether that rises to a sort of legal standard of obstruction of justice is a separate question, and ultimately a political question for the House to consider. But this is what it looks like. I mean, the president was calling, you know, multiple individuals. We at least know the head of the NSA, the director of national intelligence, and the FBI, and committee chairs to try to stop the investigatory process. And that in itself is at least sufficient evidence to consider whether or not there was obstruction of justice.
No, that makes sense. His hearing was something, you know, it was like one of the most watched things in politics, just from the numbers. And I think you're right that there are a lot of people who hadn't tuned into everything, but saw his hearing and started to think differently. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Hawaii and ask you about what are the big issues that you're focused on back home? And then how do you stay connected to and strive to represent the native Hawaiian communities? Given that you don't necessarily share their backgrounds, you are their representative, though, in the Senate. What does that look like for you?
Well, Hawaii is the most isolated, populated place on the planet. So, you know, we have a little more than 1.5 million people. We have a dense urban area in Honolulu. We've got, you know, the joint bases at Pearl Harbor and Hickam, but we're also this incredibly vast and rural state in lots of ways. We're also incredibly multicultural, not just because of the first people, the Native Hawaiians, but also because of the history of our plantation economy, where you had Portuguese and Chinese and Koreans and Americans of Japanese ancestry and Filipino Americans and Puerto Ricans all come to live and work on the plantation. And that multicultural, multi-ethnic story is really what makes Hawaii politics. So, you know, part of being successful in terms of serving well, forgetting the election side, in Hawaii is kind of understanding that history and knowing that, you know, whichever ethnic group you may belong to, that you have a responsibility to represent that patchwork. To your question specifically about Native Hawaiians, you know, we've got a real challenge. Native Hawaiians are the only Native group without a formalized government-to-government relationship. So say a Native American Indian tribe essentially has a government-to-government relationship. So it's not a race-based relationship. It's a government. It's like a treaty. And the same with Alaska Natives. Hawaiians are still in that process of being recognized by the federal government. And that's important, you know, as a practical matter in terms of, you know, federal revenue streams and other things like that that actually assist Native Hawaiians, healthcare and education and housing and stuff like that. But it's also right because of justice. It is only fair that Native Hawaiians are on a par with the other First Peoples across the country. So, you know, that's a high priority for me. And whenever there are Republicans in charge, it's a pretty high priority for the other side to undermine. I mean, just to give you a sense for how dedicated a certain portion of the right wing is to undermining Native Hawaiian rights. You know, I did this little thing with Johnny Isaacson, who's a senator from Georgia, Republican, and it was Hawaiian Food Week. It was a congratulatory thing for all of our businesses that do Hawaiian food, and that's pretty broadly defined. But among, you know, the reason Johnny was interested is because in Georgia, the King's Hawaiian Bakery has a big operation. So we just did this little congratulatory thing. Congratulatory resolutions pass pretty much automatically in the evening, maybe a couple of them every evening that the Senate is in session. It's just a way to, you know, use the stature of the Senate to shine a light on something positive happening. We had members of the Senate on the Republican side blocking this resolution because they didn't want to confer any additional rights to Native Hawaiians by congratulating, you know, King's Hawaiian Bakery and the people who make Kalua pork and the people who make guava juice and all the rest of it. I mean, it was the most preposterous thing in the world. But it shows you that there are people specifically at the Heritage Foundation whose job it is to watch all legislation for anything that might help Hawaiians and try to block it. And so that's what I'm up against.
That's wild that they're watching even the congratulatory sort of pronouncements of the Senate. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. We got it through. At the very end, this congratulatory resolution, I was texting back and forth with a senator who was blocking it, and he gave me these like three sentences that said, well, I'll be willing to let it go if you're willing to say nothing in this legislative vehicle shall confer any additional rights onto Hawaiians or any obligations onto the federal government. And I said, no. And then he backed off. But that I had to work hard to get this thing through shows you sort of, you know, that they don't, it's sort of in a bad, the Seattle Seahawks defense, right? Their philosophy is defend every blade of grass, right? And I sort of feel like the right wing does a really effective job of defending every blade of grass. And for them, it doesn't matter that it's a small thing. In fact, in a lot of ways, the message they send by defending, you know, and fighting tooth and nail on the small stuff conveys their seriousness on the big stuff. And I think that one of the things that's happened over the last, you know, several months since Trump is that our side is now thinking, hey, maybe we should defend every blade of grass.
Now, in that vein, what do you say to people who are like that the left is no longer a home for them, right? That the Democratic Party doesn't speak to their lives, that they have participated and voted and called senators and showed up to rallies. They've done it and their material conditions have not changed. What do you say to those people?
Look, I think that we have to be able to do two things at once. We have to be in the middle of the most important fight in decades, in generations, maybe in 100 years, we don't know yet. But we are in the middle of a very important fight that has to do with the future of democracy, that has to do with world order, that has to do with climate, that has to do with tens of millions of Americans and how they are treated by the Department of Justice. It has to do with tens of millions of Americans and how they are treated in terms of their own personal health care. So we're in the middle of a bunch of really important fights, and we have to engage in those fights, and we have to do them together. Sort of the middle of the left, the sort of center, you know, right, left, you know, the Republicans who, you know, can't stand Trump and are going to be make common cause with us for a minute. That's fine, too. The Bernie left, the Jill Stein left. My own view is that what is at stake is literally the planet and hundreds of millions of people's lives. And so we got to engage in those fights. But that doesn't mean we should shy away from, you know, both a strategic and a moral critique of the Democratic Party as it is currently constituted. Right. I think it is fair to say that the Democratic Party over the last 10, 15, 20 years has lost its way, that it is hard to tell people exactly what the Democratic Party stands for. And we got to do better about that. And we got to have those fights. I think that for me, you know, and I was Democratic Party chairman in the state of Hawaii. So I know a little bit about these fights. My ground rule always was we get to have these fights, but nobody gets to be engaged in this conversation about the future of the Democratic Party unless they're in, right? You got to be committed to the future of the progressive cause, and you've got to decide that for all of its flaws, and it is flawed, like structurally, you know, in terms of strategy, it doesn't have enough money, all the rest of it, right? But for all of its flaws, the Democratic Party is the best, most realistic counterweight to what the Koch brothers, the Heritage Foundation, the RNC are trying to do. And so that is our vehicle. Now, should we make it better? Yes. Should we have really interesting and important policy conversations? Should we figure out how to empower vulnerable conversations? I think all of that is what we have to do. But my own view is that we also have to respect the fact that for some people, I mean, there's the kind of, sorry to go long on this one, but for some people, it's a luxury to think about the future of the Democratic Party. For some people, it's a luxury to think about the Bernie versus Hillary thing because they're thinking, I got a pre-existing condition. So that's a very interesting right. conversation. But in the meantime, like, I might die, you know, I'm a dreamer, or my cousin is a dreamer, or you know what? I wake up every morning and I fish and I see climate change just ruining my fishery. Like, anybody who is dealing with the problems that need to be solved right now, and I know, DeRay, you focus a lot, quite correctly, on what's happening to African-American young men in the context of policing. So people who have those experiences, I think, find the whole sort of critique, and, you know, Bernie and Tom Perez are doing a unity commission, and how's that going? That's like really disconnected from anything that will impact them. And so I do think we got to do all that, but I think we have to put it in context, which means, you know, sort of like you come in the emergency room and the patient is, you know, bleeding, And then somebody comes in and goes, you know, this guy's got high cholesterol, right? I mean, it's kind of like, no, you got to deal with probably four or five absolutely urgent matters. And I think we got to do these things at the same time.
No, that makes sense. I think you're right that there are so many real life issues and things happening to people that sometimes the philosophical debates are less important. Now, one of my last questions is, you've run for office for a long time. You've been in elected office for a while. You've run for office at almost every level. What is your advice to people who are looking to get engaged for the first time, whether it's running for office or whether it's another form of being involved? What's your advice to them?
So I just gave a commencement speech, and what I said was, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. You know, you whatever it is that you feel that you can do right now, that is the right thing to be doing. I think there are a lot of people, you know, who've been asking me, probably asking you, DeRay, you know, what's the most efficacious use of my time? What's the smartest thing for me to do? I want to be strategic. I want to help maximally. And my view is, everybody should just, you know, start. Everybody should just do whatever they think they're in a position to do. I'll just tell you, I mean, when I first ran for office, I was pretty goofy walking door to door. I didn't have a proper brochure. I've always kind of looked young, but when I was 25, I didn't look 20, you know, and nobody took me seriously, and I didn't have like a voter file, and I didn't have any money, and I just kind of walked around and asked people if they would support me, you know, for the state House of Representatives. And so, you know, part of my advice to everybody, one of the reasons that the Democratic Party has some structural weaknesses is that we don't have a new generation of people running for office. And I think that's about to change in 2018. You talk about what's happening in the Virginia House. There are a bunch of encouraging signs. I think Philadelphia, a prosecutor was pretty interesting. There is a change out there. Women are running for office. People of color are running for office. And everybody's starting to figure out that what makes you a politician is a willingness to run for office. There is nothing particularly special about the category of people who are elected officials or who want to be elected officials. They've just decided to step up. And, you know, it's a citizen legislature, whether it's at the state or federal or county or city level. Everybody should run or find a campaign that they can get involved in. And I mean everybody. I mean, you know, we can have a tendency to focus too much on the coasts. And so where we're weak is in the South, where we used to not be weak, you know, in the Midwest, where we used to not be weak, because you got to field candidates. You got to give people an opportunity to make the case. So anybody who feels strongly about what's happening nationally, I mean, stay engaged nationally, but I think you should look for a school board to run for, or a county council to run for, or a candidate for the state house or state senate to get behind. And the thing about a state house or state senate race is, like, you can really be the difference maker. If you're willing to devote time and money to someone running for the assembly, you know, you're more likely to see the fruits of your labor than if you join a presidential. A presidential campaign, whether it's money or time, it's hard. It's very diffuse. It's hard to know if you make the difference. If you're helping your buddy or your mother or your college classmate run for the assembly, and you're willing to give them 5 or 10 hours a week, that is an enormous help, and you'll make a difference.
Well, thanks so much for being able to join me on this episode of Pod Save the People, and I consider you a friend of the pod and hope to have you back soon.
Thanks, DeRay. Anytime, man.
Well, that's it. Thanks for listening to Pod Save the People, and make sure that you rate it wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And make sure that you tell a friend. See you next week.